It's Thanksgiving 2017, and this is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And thank you for spending some time with us today. I love this holiday. It is absolutely my favorite one of the year. And the fact that a major corporate coffee maker introduced its winter cups at the beginning of November this year is not going to dampen my enthusiasm for Thanksgiving. Nope, 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 it will not. Because for so many of us, Thanksgiving is a time for family and to return home in whatever form home may take. So this hour, we're bringing you some of our favorite segments about the many meanings of home. Let's start with an obvious observation. Home, of course, isn't a fixed place. Great oceans of humanity move around the world generation after generation. Some violently, migrants and refugees who are forced to flee. Others by choice, emigrants who become immigrants in their new homeland. So let's listen back to a conversation we had with artist Wen T. Sen. Last year, his remarkable art installation took the life-sized images of men and women, grandparents and professors, workers and small children who haven't been seen in Chinatown for maybe 100 years. They were 12 historical photos of Chinatown residents, enlarged, transferred to wood sheets, and lovingly hand-painted by the 81-year-old Sen. He then returned them to the streets of Chinatown. Now, Sen says he wanted modern-day Bostonians to come eye-to-eye with the faces from the past, for people to take in their existence, to see how the neighborhood has changed, and to see them with sisterly or brotherly empathy. We met Wen T. Sen and some of his evocative wooden cutouts right under the Chinatown gate last September in 2016, and we started by looking at a cutout of a little boy and girl.
It's a boy and a girl. And I think the boy looks like about 4 years old, mm-hmm. and the girl maybe 2 years older. And it was from a picture that was taken, I assume, in the early 40s.
Was this photograph taken in Boston?
Yeah, actually, just down the street, where they live. In fact, these are two people who later grew into sort of very important people in the community.
Well, so the title of the installation is Hometown.
Yeah, right.
Right? And you're representing, I love that, yeah. Boston's Chinatown as a place of people.
Yes.
So what is the story of these two children? Tell us.
Well, the reason I use the hometown as two separate words, right, because one's association, I think in hometown America, USA, or hometown USA, has a certain quality that is like almost like a Midwestern town with lawns in the front. But I'm trying to say is, actually, Chinatown itself is a home to a lot of people. And it's been here for, the whole idea is that it's been here for over 100 years. And so the home in that sense is much wider than the geographic area of Chinatown, but so that it becomes the home of all the Chinese Americans in the New England kind of thing.
Well, can we walk to another part of the installation here, just down the road a little bit? Why did you want to do this now?
This home that we're talking about is actually being threatened by different kind of expansion of the city. Urban renewal in the 1960s.
Yeah, in the mid-20th century.
Yeah,
right.
Which was, they built highways mm-hmm. and demolishing. And a lot of the inner city at that time was devalued.
Yeah.
So they say, Chinatown especially, there's not much political power at the city hall. So they look at this thing as a derelict place. And then now it's a whole new situation.
Gentrification.
Right, exactly. When you have a block that has three-story, four-story buildings that rent for a few hundred dollars, that people have been living there for 50 years or something, when you have offers of building 50-story high buildings with the top floor for several million dollars, then the temptation to sell is very, very great.
Well, we're right next to this other figure here. Again, these are all life-size now.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
So we have the image of a man. He's wearing, is it a bow tie? Mm-hmm. He's quite smartly dressed.
Yes.
A nice little hat and a walking stick as well. Who is he?
I love him. I guess he was taken a photo from a picnic in Maine in the early 20th century. So they tried to learn become Americans, Americanized at that time. And he was obviously had a pretty good tutor who got him into a very smart dress and a rose on his
skirt. But I was going to say, he's even got the rose on his buttonhole.
Yes, right, yeah. So actually what I'm trying to capture is there was a kind of pride in his, you know, appearance.
Now, is there another one? Yes, oh, there's that one there. We'll take a look at that one. It occurs to me, I know there are 12 figures total in the installation. Where did you find the photographs, first of all?
It's with the Chinese Historical Society of New England.
Were you able to find pictures of people at work?
That's the trouble, actually. It's rather difficult because all the pictures are of people who are in a position of more or less power, that they are put into that, and it's a very strongly oriented to a patriarchal society.
You were able to find a picture of a laundryman?
Yes. I would love to look at the talk about the laundryman.
Yes,
actually.
Please. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's so interesting because walking around here and the fact that you made them life-sized and have colorized the images as well, I mean, almost as if it feels like they are here with us.
Right.
It's like ghosts of Chinatown brought to
exactly,
life.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Actually, for me, it's actually two things. One was, there's a funeral quality of bringing back ghosts, but by colorizing them, I almost make them alive so that they are relating to us as the real people.
Well, let's go talk about the laundryman.
Yes. Oh, I'd love to take a picture of that. Sorry. It's a monk who are looking at the...
Yeah.
Do you mind if I...
Oh, no, please, go ahead. So we're headed towards one of the figures in the installation. It's the image of the laundryman. And right now there's a... Looks like he's a Buddhist monk standing in front of the image. He's dressed in his orange robes and sandals, and he's this shaved head, and he's reading the placard describing what the laundryman figure is all about.
This guy... his name is Yuk Guang Dong. He was the last one that I found. In fact, I couldn't find him. Couldn't find any working people, as you mentioned earlier, in the books and things like that. By all his portrait, he looked like a rather small person. But I made him to in between so that he's about my size now. But I think he might have been 5'2" or something like that. And his gesture, everything is so very contained. It has that show that his whole hard life. And for me, he represents all the hard work that the Chinese laundryman has gone through in all those years. And that's why when I put in his eyes and looking at us, it's like kind of a quality of his humanity that has come through that we're relating to each other.
Yeah. Now, when you talk about his demeanor and his posture in the image, it's true, his hands are sort of crossed below his waist.
Yes.
And he's wearing, looks like, very simple clothes, just a jacket and pants and a white shirt.
It does look like, but when I looked at him in total, he has a hat on that is a little bit, sort of like a secondhand clothing store, a kind of cap from a sort of leftover from a Harvard student. And his whole clothes is rather unfitting. At the same time, it's creased, and his shoes are polished.
Yeah.
And I think it was his Sunday best. He actually, the shop is, very interestingly, is in Blue Hill Avenue, if you know Boston.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the poorest districts. I think at that time there was a certain amount of Asian immigrants there,
yeah.
Chinese immigrants.
Well, Wen-Ti, do you mind if I ask you, clearly, as we've been walking down the path here and seeing your work and hearing you talk, this idea of home, it's obvious that it's so very important to
right.
you, not just for the Asian American community here in Boston, but I wonder, what does home mean to you? Because your own life has been one of a global travel, whether you wanted it to be or not.
When I grew up in China, I had home for 3 or 4 years, the real home that I love. But then it was never there because of the revolution, Second World War, and all that stuff. And then we'll move from our home to another city, and then to another country, to Paris, London, and things like that. So home became the part that I carry within me. So being a Chinese, I find that home is a visionary thing within, And this, my home is different to another Chinese American's home. No, that's why I feel that hometown, like Chinatown, in a way, create that feeling of being, you know, we have certain amount of things together. It wasn't until when I was 50 years old and start painting one of the murals to protest, one of the gentrification, the development thing, that I got to be working with people in Chinatown. And I did find a kind of a home here, not because of affinity.
Now, I think you've actually been a little humble in terms of your own family story and your story, because, you, as you said, you had to leave China after the Second World War, right?
After the revolution.
After the revolution.
Yeah.
And then your family moved to France and
right.
England?
Yeah, I was. My mother was educated in France.
Yeah.
When the revolution came, it became a rather natural thing for her to go back to Paris,
right.
Which is my, you know, my loveliest time. I was 13, 14, and what can you lose when you're 13, 14 in Paris? And then I was sent to school in London, which was our post-Second World War London. Was not a very nice place.
And then when did you come to the United States?
My brother started teaching in Boston, and my mother, you know, she got her to come, and my second brother, and I was left in Europe, that's in the art school, for 2 years. And that was in art school in Europe, you don't have to do very much. You can just go and look at things.
So you have been an immigrant then multiple times.
Yes.
Different
yes.
countries, different
right.
different eras and in different ways. I mean, what has your immigrant experience meant to you?
I think that's, yeah, actually my, you know, aside from these public art things, my own paintings deals with that experience. What it is, I think, being an immigrant, you have several layers of yourself. They're all selves. Again, it's like a home. You have several homes inside you, and you can present, open up these different doors to these different homes to show people. But there are about 10 different homes in your life that you do not show the person that you're with. So when I'm in Chinatown, I will open one door, and when I'm in another place, in, you know, in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, I'll open quite different doors. It's to show that layering of, I think it's really kind of wonderful, that it's only in America in that sense that you can have that. That you, because in Europe, like a Frenchman is a Frenchman, an immigrant is an immigrant, no, outsider. Whereas in America, you can be an American and an immigrant too.
Cambridge-based artist Wen T. Sen. He walked us through his installation, Hometown, Re-presenting Boston's Chinatown as a Place of People. It was on display in Chinatown September 2016. And don't worry, if you missed seeing the installation in person, we've got some great photographs of it at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this special Thanksgiving edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're listening back to some of our favorite conversations about home. And this next one might come as a bit of a surprise, but to truly appreciate it, we have to first go back to October 1991.
Professor, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
Thank you. Professor Hill, please make whatever statement you would wish to make to the committee.
Anita Hill. Her name is now synonymous with so many things. Controversy, courage, even conspiracy. But more than a quarter century ago, when she appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee and accused then-Judge Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment, Anita Hill was simply a 35-year-old law professor at the University of Oklahoma.
His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films, involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes.
Hill's testimony broke the silence around workplace sexual harassment. Looking back now, it's fair to wonder how much or how little has actually changed since then. Those hearings turned Hill into a complex political icon. The black woman facing a barrage of questions from a panel of white men. The black woman who forced the nation to rethink its conception of equality. Here she is responding to Senator Howell Heflin, Democrat of Alabama.
Do you have a militant attitude relative to the area of civil rights?
No, I don't have a militant attitude.
Do you have a martyr complex?
No, I don't.
Well, the issue of fantasy has arisen.
There is no indication of that I'm an individual who is not in touch with reality on a regular basis that would be subject to fantasy.
Are you interested in writing a book?
No, I'm not interested in writing a book.
People say, well, how could you answer the senator's questions?
Anita Hill is now a professor at Brandeis University.
And I can only say that I knew that if I could live up to my mother's standards, that the senators would pale in comparison, that they would not be a challenge at all. And so I pitched my my testimony to her high standards.
In fact, Hill's mother and her 12 older brothers and sisters sat right behind her during the Thomas hearings. Anita Hill says their presence brought her a sense of stability. You see, home had come with her to Washington. This idea of home, the ultimate symbol of economic success and equality, it was at the center of Anita Hill's 2012 book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. It's a deeply personal look at the American dream, beginning with the story of Hill's own family and ending with the social costs of the housing crisis. She and I talked about the book and lasting legacy of the Thomas hearings when I visited Anita Hill in 2012 at what she calls her academic home, Brandeis University. We began with the fact that within the span of just one generation, members of Anita Hill's own family went from being someone's property to being property owners themselves. Hill started with the story of her great-grandmother, Molly Elliott.
Molly Elliott, let me just say that my family story for me was what really clarified in my mind the idea that home is not just that space, the place where we live, but it's also a state of being.
She's your great-grandmother.
My great-grandmother, enslaved in rural Arkansas and pregnant. And she was sold away from the man who she was living with as her husband. She was moved to a county called Little River County, Arkansas. And she remained there as a slave after she gave birth to my grandfather. Shortly after she gave birth to my grandfather, the war ended, and she was a free person. And for the first time in her life, she had to experience life as a free person and to understand what that meant, even as she was living in the place where she had been enslaved, in the same cabin. So the state of mind, her state of mind, had to change. And I think as a way of showing that she was not the same Molly who had been enslaved. Actually, she became Molly Elliott after she became a free woman. She changed her name from where she had been as Mary and began to raise her son, my grandfather, Henry Elliott,
May I stop you for just one moment? Because during and after the Civil War, so here we have a moment in history, in your family's history, where the same location takes on two very profoundly different significances.
Right. The place has not changed at all, but her condition has changed. And psychologically, she must change, and she must teach her son to live as a free person, something that she'd never experienced herself. And I believe the evidence of her having done that was ultimately in his life. He was then able to take advantage of the laws that allowed for homesteading and to accumulate 80 acres of land in the same area. So it was a transition of years, really about 4 or 5 decades, that they really began to exercise their freedom. And so that's the state of being at home, not only as a space, and then take that space and transform it into not something that reminded them of being enslaved, but something that signified their freedom.
Could they have done that without the Homesteading Act, without actually being vested owners of the land?
I think ownership, because it is such a part of what we think of as the American dream, that ownership took on symbolic significance. And so for them, yes, definitely in that generation, ownership was essential. But my cousin, who tells the story of their owning the property, also tells me that they lost it. There were some debt agreements that were completely one-sided. There was a downturn in the agricultural economy. And there was also a threat of racial violence. My grandfather was threatened to be lynched. And with all of those things together, ultimately, I think it was the racial violence that forced them really off the land and forced their movement to Oklahoma, which is where I grew up. My grandparents never again owned property, but they were able to accumulate enough money to give my mother a gift when she got married so that she could begin to build her own home. And she and my father did own a farm that I grew up on.
So in a sense, they were able to at least transmit a gift that helped rebuild the sense of home.
They were rebuilding the dream, I believe, in the next generation.
Did she, as you were growing up, ever emphasize to you that being a property owner was an important part of how you might measure success in your life?
Absolutely. And it wasn't something that she said, you have to have your own home. She first said, you have to have your own education. And I didn't realize, I don't think, how important owning a home was for her, my ownership of a home was for her, until I bought my first home. And I did so in Oklahoma. And she saw that as a symbol of my having made it.
See, the reason why I ask is, and forgive me for bringing in my own family history into this, but...
Not at all. I mean, can I just interject?
Sure.
Because I want people, as they read my story, to bring in their own thinking about home as we place ourselves in the world and try to understand our own experience and movement toward equality.
Well, I couldn't help but to do that because my parents are immigrants. They came from India. They grew up in impoverished circumstances in India where property ownership was not even a possibility. But they had successful immigrant experience here in the United States. I clearly remember when my parents bought their first home. I was 7 years old when we moved in. And ever since then, you know, my father especially, for a long time, until the recent housing crisis, you know, he told me, he tried to say over and over again, by the time you're in your mid-30s, try to own a home.
It's a place where we begin to build on our dreams. That home, whether we own it or rent it, when we feel safe and secure in that space. And so it is a very, I hesitate to use the word sacred, but for many of us, it is a space that allows us to grow and become the best of who we can be. That is ultimately what we want from a home.
I'm speaking with Professor Anita Hill at her office at Brandeis University. Her book is Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. So in your book, in the introduction, there's a very challenging statement that you make. You say, I raise the question of whether the idea of home as a repository of the American dream and the signifier of equality can coexist with the concept of housing as a measure of national economic prosperity. Now, you would think that if we were living in a society where we had reached a certain level of equality, that national economic prosperity would be strongly correlated with that. But are you saying that they should no longer be correlated, that we should disconnect the two?
I'm saying that as long as we allow economic inequalities to exist, then we can't ever expect to close the gap because the cost of housing is increasing. But we're not keeping pace with that in terms of economic equity and equality for so many people. We know that gender and race are all still indicators of our economic wealth.
And so using housing as a measure masks those basic inequities.
It just allows those inequities to continue. Historically, what we have said to people is that, and I use this, my model I use is the Jeffersons. When we knew the sitcom of the Jeffersons that came out in the 70s and 80s, we knew that George and Louise Jefferson had made it.
They were moving on
because
up.
They were moving on up to the Upper East Side, and it was so idyllic that they described it as a deluxe apartment in the sky. And that was a measure of African Americans having made it in America. But it's something that is not achievable for most Americans. We can't continue to measure prosperity in a way that is unachievable for most of us. That model that we held out there for people in the Jeffersons will not work in the 21st century.
The last couple of questions I have for you, Professor Hill, it is the 20th anniversary of the time where you sat in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the now infamous Clarence Thomas hearings. I know you've been asked this before, but, you know, Herman Cain, he's no longer running for the GOP nomination for president because several women came forward and alleged that he had sexually harassed them. So on the one hand, the very fact that women felt courageous and supportive enough to do so, to come forward, I think says we've come a long way since 1991. But on the other hand, at least one of those women in particular chose to stay anonymous because her lawyer was quoted as saying she didn't want to end up being the next Anita Hill. When you heard that, what did that make you think about overall the progress that's been made regarding sexual harassment?
Well, it is a difficult thing to come forward, but I can say that a lot of women have come forward and they've come forward publicly. But it is it's a difficult choice and it's a personal choice. I can't say that I like being Anita Hill and I wouldn't trade my place with anyone else. But there is another part of it, the story. Americans confirmed that this behavior matters, that sexual harassment matters. It is a reflection on the character and the judgment of individuals who participate in it, who engage in harassing behavior. It is a reflection on their respect for the law, and it's a reflection on their ability to be leaders. And so I think that has been affirmed. I will say this, though. We are not going to be able to change the behavior in 20 years. This is behavior that has been going on since time immemorial. And so to think that we are going to be able to get rid of it in 20 years is not realistic. But I think we've moved monumentally in the 20 years since the hearings.
Now, regarding those hearings, you were 35?
Yes.
At the time? I'm 36 now, and it's hard, if not impossible, for me to imagine myself doing what you did at the age I am now, sitting before the Senate Judiciary Committee and those senators who at that time were all white men, and making testimony and sharing a story that was going to change political history in America. So I guess my question for you is, at that moment, when you were at that table, how were you feeling? I mean, what was your heart rate like? What was going through your mind?
Well, I don't think at that moment that I had any real sense of what would happen in the future. And maybe I wouldn't even allow myself to think about that. My purpose in testifying was to really tell the truth about my experience. And that's what I had in mind doing. And that was a task that I had set for myself. My task wasn't to change, even to change the senator's mind, but it was to be able to tell my story and the truth that of what I had experienced in the workplace. And so, yes, I was anxious about that, but I didn't have the weight of the world in the sense that you describe on my shoulders at that point.
In fact, if I remember correctly, in a sense, you brought home with you into the hearing room because many members of your family came.
Well, I tell it in the sense that my mom was there, my father was there, But my mother really was the person who did most of the child rearing responsibilities and discipline and structure. And so if I left that room and she was pleased with me, I knew that I would have done what I had set out to do.
Professor Anita Hill, speaking to me back in 2012 about her book, Reimagining Equality, Stories of Gender, Race, and Finding Home. We'll be right back. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to this Thanksgiving edition of Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakraborty. This hour, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations about home. And for Cambridge novelist Celeste Ng, her real-life hometown of Shaker Heights, Ohio, is where she set her latest novel. It's called Little Fires Everywhere, and we talked about it back in September. And Ng told us about Shaker Heights and why she set a story of race, family, and identity there.
Shaker Heights is a suburb on the east side of Cleveland. It's a really beautiful place that's got a lot of trees. It's got a lot of green to it. The houses are beautiful. And my parents moved there in the early 90s because it's known for having great schools and it's known for being very racially diverse. And so it was a really great place to grow up. And it was only when I moved away that I started to realize it was a little bit unusual.
What is it about where you are in your writing career right now that made you decide that, yeah, you could actually set your novel in this real place, that one that you do know so well?
I don't know. It was hubris, I guess, is the answer. But I wanted to try because I had been away from home long enough that I was sort of used to living on my own as an adult, and I had by that time had a child. And I started, therefore, thinking back to my own childhood. And I think thinking about that sort of comparison, comparing the place that I live in now, Cambridge, to the place that I grew up in, comparing the time that we live in now to the time that I grew up in, I would have been a teenager at the time that this book took place in the 90s, that's kind of where that the novel came from, that sort of investigating how far have we come, that question.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about who we meet, who the folks who are at the heart of the novel Little Fires Everywhere. First of all, there's the Richardson family. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so they are sort of on the outside, at least, the prototypical American suburban family. You know, mother, father. The mother is a journalist for the local paper. The father is a lawyer. They've got four kids. They kind of embody the town in a way. And so they're sort of following the rules. They sort of buy into this kind of idea that the town is exceptional in some way and that they're there to set an example.
Right. It's sort of conformity is the word that comes to mind.
But I think so, yeah.
But then in rushes sort of a very, like an opposite force into their lives in the form of Mia Warren and her daughter, Pearl. So tell us about them and why is it that you decided to bring these two very different types of people together.
Yeah, so Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl come in. They're the strangers from out of town. Mia is in a lot of ways sort of the opposite of this town. She's a wanderer. They move around quite a lot. She's an artist, so she doesn't have a very fixed income. She doesn't have a very stable career. And they're sort of polar opposites to the Richardson family. And I was really interested in the idea of those two families kind of being drawn to each other. So often you're interested in people who live a life that's really different from yours.
Yeah. In my reading of it, there's a deep common theme that courses through the Richardson family, through Mia Warren and her daughter, and another family also in the book, and that is sort of how do we define parent-child relationships, especially when either those children aren't biologically born as a part of their family, or B, even your biological children are perhaps attracted to the parents of another family because they're getting something from that other person that they may not be getting from their own mother and father. I mean, that's a really complicated web. I'm mixing my metaphors now. A complicated web to wade into. But what is it about those kind of relationships that you find so interesting as a novelist?
Well, I've always been interested in the parent-child relationships and the ways that parents, even though you'd think they would be the ones who would understand their children the best, that's not always true, unfortunately. Sometimes you're so close to your own child that you can't see who they really are or what they really need. And in the novels, you said there are a lot of mother-daughter, mother-child pairings. both between the mother that you're born to and the mother that you sort of choose, or maybe the mother that chose you, and you get different things from those.
I mean, to speak specifically about it, like Pearl and Izzy here, right? Like Pearl there's a part of her that's really compelled by Mrs. Richardson, and Izzy finds something very compelling in Mia, right?
Mm-hmm. They're, in some ways, I think they're drawn to the woman who's very unlike their own mother.
Has that ever happened to you?
I feel like, you know, I'm lucky that I've had a really good relationship with my mother, but my mom is her own specific person. And, you know, my mom is a scientist. She's a chemist. She taught PhD students, and she does research in the lab. And I clearly have turned myself in a slightly different direction as a writer. And so I feel like there have been other women in my life that I turn to for just different kinds of mentoring.
Yeah.
You find people that you turn to, and there's often a moment where you go, well, wait, am I betraying my own mother in some way by turning to this other person for advice?
So I know exactly how you feel. I mean, it's funny, your mom's a chemist, so is mine.
Really?
I mean, and I look, I adore my mother, but she's a chemist. She's very sort of logic and accomplishment oriented, and of course also being an immigrant, an American by choice, there was always that drive from the beginning to, you know, like, there are life goals, and so I got that drive from her. But I did find that maybe not so much when I was younger, but in my teen years and in my 20s and 30s, just like you said, like in other women, I found sort of other aspects of ways of being that nurtured me that I didn't get from my mother.
Yeah, I think that's basically exactly the experience I had. My mother, also an immigrant, you know, an American by choice. She came over in the 60s, and she's very, you know, she's very much in the science mode of thinking. She's very logical. She's very problem-solving oriented, and she gets things done. And I got that from her. But at the same time, every now and then, there are times where you, as you said, you want to experience a different way of being in the world, or a different way of relating to the world. And
yeah.
I feel like that's natural, and yet it also, I had a lot of guilt about
me
that.
Me too. It's very, it makes you feel really fraught, because it feels like a kind of, as you're saying, a little bit of a betrayal, even though it's not, but it feels that way.
That's exactly it, and I think about it now as a parent, as I know you are also, where I sort of think, well, what about those moments where your kid says, oh yeah, but I want to go over to that person's house because their mom does this, you know, or no, I want to do that with grandma. And there's a little bit where you're like, oh,
yeah.
You don't want to do that with me, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I find myself, it's like I'm coming back around, finally, to a deeper appreciation of my mother now that I've got my own children to mother.
That's
well.
Exactly where I am as well, where I'm sort of now. I feel like there are certain things where I understand why she did things when I was a kid, or I see things now from her point of view in a way that I thought I did before, but I realize that I really didn't quite understand before. And now I feel like I'm starting to understand a little better.
Well, this seems like a great place for me to ask you if you could read an excerpt from Little Fires Everywhere, because I want folks to hear your writing. The writing's also beautiful as well. So could you do that?
Sure. So this is just to frame it, a little passage in which Mia, who is the mother who comes from out of town, is thinking about her relationship with her daughter, Pearl. Parents, she thought, learned to survive touching their children less and less. As a baby, Pearl had clung to her. She'd worn Pearl in a sling because whenever she'd set her down, Pearl would cry. There'd been scarcely a moment in the day when they had not been pressed together. As she got older, Pearl would still cling to her mother's leg, then her waist, then her hand, as if there were something in her mother she needed to absorb through the skin. Even when she had her own bed, she would often crawl into Mia's in the middle of the night and burrow under the old patchwork quilt, and in the morning they would wake up tangled, Mia's arm pinned beneath Pearl's head, or Pearl's legs thrown across Mia's belly. Now, as a teenager, Pearl's caresses had become rare, a peck on the cheek, a one-armed, half-hearted hug, and all the more precious because of that. It was the way of things, Mia thought to herself, but how hard it was. The occasional embrace, a head leaned for just a moment on your shoulder, when what you really wanted, more than anything, was to press them to you and hold them so tight you fused together and could never be taken apart. It was like training yourself to live on the smell of an apple alone, when what you really wanted was to devour it, to sink your teeth into it and consume it, seeds, core, and all.
Oh, that's Celeste Ng reading from her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere. Oh, that really gets to me, Celeste, I have to say, because right now I have a both my kids are in single digits, so, and every time their sort of Velcro-y nature gets to me, I'm gonna reread this passage and remind myself that I will miss it.
I'm in exactly soon. The same spot with my son has just started first grade, and he's very into being independent, and then every so often he's very clingy, and I have to kind of remind myself, you're gonna miss that.
I'm gonna miss it. I'm gonna think about the smell of an apple. So there's also this aspect of the book which is really important that we haven't touched on yet, and it has to do with sort of how we define and how society defines what an appropriate family actually is, right? Because there's also the story in the novel about a white family raising a Chinese baby.
There's been a Chinese baby that's been abandoned at the fire station, and she's been adopted by a well-to-do white family living in Shaker Heights. And one of the subplots of the novel has to do with the mother of this Chinese baby who kind of wants her child back. And the question of who this child belongs to, who is the child's mother? Is it the mother who gave birth to her, or is it the mother who's been taking care of her? And it leads, in fact, to a sort of conflict in the community that actually divides the entire community and causes a split between the Richardsons and between Mia and Pearl.
I mean, is there, at the risk of sounding too simplistic, does your opinion fall on one side or the other?
I can't decide, honestly. It sounds like an authorial cop-out, but one of the things that I wanted to do was just sort of to pose this question and to show how complicated this situation is, that both of these mothers, really both of these sets of parents, have a claim on this child and love this child and have a reason to want this child in their lives, and that whichever family the child ends up with, unfortunately, she's going to be missing something.
Yeah, interesting. Finally, I just wonder, you know, we talked a little bit about how your upbringing in Shaker Heights, we talked about our mothers as well. I mean, how much, maybe I'm asking this as a person who speaks to a lot of authors, and sometimes I wonder, should I be sort of saying, like, here's an author that, in part because of her own ethnic background, engages a lot with issues of ethnicity and race? Because I always wonder if authors, like, push back against that, because they're also just writing great stories.
No, I feel both sides of that question, actually, because especially when I started off as a debut author, I was really nervous about being pigeonholed.
Right, as the new Chinese-American
exactly
writer.
Exactly, right. The next Amy Tan, like, there can only be one, and somebody has to knock her off the pedestal in order to, you know, get anywhere, which is something that I really, really struggle against and really push back against now that I have a little bit of a voice. I think as a writer of color, you know, somebody who's been in marginalized situations in different ways, I think that I'm really aware of what it's like to be an outsider. And so even when I'm writing, as in this novel, about many characters who are white, I still think that I bring to it the perspective of what it's like to be an outsider and how hard that can be and how that can shape someone.
Novelist Celeste Ng spoke with us back in September when her novel Little Fires Everywhere was first published. Finally today, we want to end with a story that's become a bit of a tradition here at Radio Boston. It's the story of Scott McCauley. McCauley lives in Melrose, and for the past 32 years, he's opened his heart and his Thanksgiving table to complete strangers who would otherwise have been alone on this day. McCauley has been doing this since he was just 24 years old. And Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks talked with McCauley in 2014 about why, for a holiday so intimately associated with family, he chooses to welcome strangers to his table instead.
In 1985, my folks split up. And in September, nobody was speaking to each other.
Oh, boy.
And if I did something nice to Ma, Dad got a little not too pleased. If I did something for Dad, Ma was definitely not pleased. I don't like to eat alone, and the thought of having Thanksgiving alone, looking at the walls, watching the TV, was not something that I really wanted to do, and really was not looking forward to it at all. So I put a little ad in the Melrose Free Press, which is a local paper, and said that if anybody thought that they would find themselves alone on Thanksgiving Day, and they didn't want to be, give me a call, and I'll cook a turkey.
And how many people showed up that first time?
I limited it to 12.
I see.
Because I wasn't sure how this was going to work. 12 came, and I've been doing it ever since.
That's amazing. So are you a good cook? Did you know how to cook then? Were you a good
cook? I still don't know how to cook. Thanksgiving dinner is really easy. Yeah. The directions are on the bird bag, and you put it in the oven, let it do its thing, And in the meantime, you peel the squash and peel the potatoes and you boil them to death.
And that's it.
So even I can't mess that up too bad.
So, Scott, you started with 12 people. How big has this Thanksgiving dinner gotten that you do every year? What was the highest number of people that came?
The highest number was 89.
89.
On my 25th year.
Wow. How'd you do that? Cook for 89 people.
You do the same way you do for the 12. You just do a little bit more.
Yeah, and who comes? I'd love to hear about the mixture of people.
We have sometimes children, mm-hmm. 5 or 6 years old. The oldest was 95. We had one lady that came from a nursing home that hadn't been out for 7 years and paid $200 plus mileage to get there, and I told her my cooking wasn't worth that. People that are recently divorced. Yeah. I had some Vietnamese people last year that didn't speak a word of English, but they apparently liked it because they stayed. I had a girl one time that was coming down from New Hampshire to see her dad at Mass General, and he was diagnosed with a brain tumor the next day, but she was in the air. So there's all different reasons why people come, and it changes from year to year.
Do they end up coming back, the same people?
Well, it changes.
It changes, right.
Sometimes they get remarried, or they get the girlfriend. Or sometimes people come because they don't like their family, and they've mended the fence in the family. Some people come every other year because you know how the in-law thing works.
Right. Well, Scott, why do you do it? Is this, you're just a good guy. You're just kind of a saint.
Nope. I tease people because people like you say that. I said, no, I'm a mean old guy, and I would be home alone on Thanksgiving, so I do this so I have something to do. But really, I did not like the thought of spending the day alone.
Right.
And I don't want anybody that's within my reach to have to spend the day home alone. I've never turned anybody away.
Wow.
I had a couple come at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I says, can I help you? And they said, we came for the Thanksgiving dinner. I says, it started at 1. She says, well, we heard about it, and we've both lost our jobs. And we drove up from West Bridgewater. I says, we'll find something for you.
Well, that's nice. Yeah. These stories, though, they must make you feel so good. I mean, you're connecting with people on such a personal level on such an important day.
Yeah, well, that's what makes you want to do it again the next year.
Yeah. And I want to point out, I mean, if I understand this correctly, this all comes out of your pocket, right? You pay
for
this?
Well, for most of the years that I did it, yes. I don't ask for donations, never have, never will, because at this time of year, every time you open the mailbox, there's solicitations for wonderful charities. If somebody or a group gives me something, I'll take it if I still can use it.
Yeah.
If I've already got what I need, unfortunately for some people, I tell them I'm all set and recommend like Bread of Life in Malden. Sometimes they're not too pleased with me. Sometimes they think I'm nuts.
You mean you'll
for
actually
not taking the money?
You'll actually turn down?
Oh,
a,
no,
a donation.
I do it. Oh yeah. So like anything this week when I'm all set, I turn them down.
So can I ask what's the tab for Thanksgiving dinner for
well,
anywhere from 60 to 80?
All over the table.
Yeah, you've got all kinds of receipts here.
I haven't added it up for this year.
Yeah, but generally, what
generally speaking, the last few years a little over $1,000.
$1,000 for 62.
But that's because they get the full setup of food.
Yeah, no, it sounds like a great deal.
They get a darn good meal.
How long do you imagine yourself doing this?
Well, I got to keep doing it. There's a need for it.
Yeah.
The goal is to have nobody sign up, which means everybody's got a place to go. Then I can not have to do it. But anybody can do this. Hmm. Every town should have somebody doing this. And even if you don't want to do it on the scale that I do it on it, just invite one person over that's extra. Just make sure everybody that's in your life space has a place to go. Don't let anybody stay home alone.
That's Scott McCauley speaking with Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks back in 2014. And today, McCauley is serving Thanksgiving dinner once again, as he's done for the past 32 years. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Happy Thanksgiving. This is Radio Boston.